Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
Hello, my name's Marcia Mary Baker, and I have the pleasure of interviewing today a guest from Australia for the LaRouche Connection. With me today is Lance Endersby, and he's traveling and visiting in the United States. And we have many things to talk about. He has been an engineer with vast experience, and he's now actively retired and pursuing some basic science. And his specialty has been infrastructure. He's a member of the Order of Australia. He's emeritus professor and was also dean at Monash University in Melbourne. And he has much experience, beginning with after the Second World War, in building projects in Australia, especially the famed Snowy Mountain Project. So it's a pleasure to have you, Lance.
Thank you.
And I want to say what I think we're going to talk about today could come under three areas. Yeah. First, the what you actually built, tunnels, projects, underground facilities for power and so forth in the last 50 years in Australia. Secondly, what you propose, though, for the future, that we haven't built enough, we have a deficit. Yeah. And third, and this is where I'd like to begin, though, with all your experience, literally, in the earth, tunnels and the rest, you have some very burning views on misconceptions in earth sciences.
Yes.
And hydrology and chemistry and geochemistry. So I'd like to begin there first, if that's okay. So do you want to say, I know it concerns groundwater, do you want to begin with your experience in Australia in the Great Artesian Basin or elsewhere?
Oh, okay. Well, let's start with the Great Artesian Basin. The Great Artesian Basin is the largest artesian basin in the world. And for the last 100 years and more, it has been believed that the water that is coming out of the earth is surface waters which has traveled to that spot from rainfall on from points far away, 1,000 kilometers away. And this idea of recharge of groundwater from surface rainfall is characteristic not only of the Great Artesian Basin, but of all major artesian basins in the world.
Yeah, I think we have the Ogallala Basin in the United States.
The Ogallala Basin is an excellent example. And basins like that are just not being recharged from surface rainfall at all. Yet the professions involved believe that to be the case. And so in the Ogallala Basin, for example, we've had the simple mining.
Yes, the level's gone way down.
They're just mining the groundwater. The same is happening not only in this Great Artesian Basin in Australia, but also right through the Middle East, all of the Muslim countries, and all the way from Morocco through Algeria, Libya, Egypt, and then into Iraq and Iran. All of those countries are exploiting their available groundwater. And the important thing to note is that that groundwater is not rechargeable from surface rainfall.
So where does it come from?
Well, it is water that is part of the original constitution of the earth. And it's the same as the water that comes up as steam from volcanoes and gushes from the deep ocean vents. So we have water which was part of the original constitution of the earth. And people have had difficulty in grasping that. But in recent years, we've had a wonderful lot of information coming to us from exploration in outer space, all these wonderful space vehicles. And can I just recommend to everybody, and particularly the young people, everybody should look at something that is readily available on the internet, and that is the Astronomy Picture of the Day, APOD, A-P-O-D. Go to APOD on the internet, have a look at the Astronomy Picture of the Day. Every day there is a wonderful image from the Hubble Space Telescope and others, the Anglo-Australian Observatory, the Subaru people in Japan. They are all producing these wonderful images of what's going on in outer space. The flood of information is so great that it defies interpretation.
So you're saying this relates to the water in the universe, or hydrogen, or characteristics?
That's right.
As in Mars?
As in Mars.
Okay.
Yes, well, you see, you just showed me that thing, a piece of news.
There's
that,
news from Mars.
News from Mars that they've had water flooding on Mars. all the work from Hubble and the others has shown us that there's the universe has got lots of hydrogen molecules, and it was these hydrogen molecules that were part of the original constitution of the Earth. And now that's easy to believe. And that also, these hydrogen molecules include methane. So we now know that methane may have been part of the original constitution of the Earth. At the moment, there's a space probe going out to look at one, I think it's a moon of Saturn, which has a great concentration of water and methane. And of course, if there's lots of methane on a moon of Saturn, why do we always think that the only methane and petroleum on the Earth comes from biological sources?
Yes, the theory is that there were plants in ancient times and then they were compressed and that formed oil.
That's right.
But you're saying...
I'm saying the methane was there beforehand. Mm-hmm. And the other thing about the winning of petroleum, petroleum is in effect floating on water. There's a water drive underneath the methane and the petroleum. In the case of methane, we have very dense, if you like, solutions of methane in water. You know, sometimes 150 times volume on a comparative basis.
Where is this measured? You mean you encounter it? We're
finding it now in the probes into the deep sediments in the ocean. They're finding these high concentrations of methane in the sediments in the ocean. And of course, they're as I indicate, they're part of the composition of the Earth itself. When a volcano explodes...
Yes, I think we have a view of one of the Mount St. Helena or one of the others.
That's right. Well, when a volcano explodes, it is really the explosion of a water-rich mixture, if you like, deeper than 100 kilometers or so down. And a volcano should be seen as a spontaneous disintegration of what is, in effect, water-rich rocks. And the water is an intrinsic part of the composition of these rocks. And an easy way to visualize this is to think about granites, for example. Uh-huh. And a granite will contain white crystals and
quartz.
Quartz.
Yeah.
And the white quartz, the whiteness, is microscopic globules of water.
That's so. Geochemistry, that's so.
Yes. Uh-huh. So quartz, white quartz, has got water in it. Mm-hmm. And that means that rocks like granite could have only formed in the presence of water. And so we have these intensely concentrated, hot, siliceous-type solutions. Mm-hmm. All of the metal sulfides, you know, the metal mines around the world, they can be seen as precipitations from strong water hydrothermal solutions.
So it's fluid transformations, and we still see it in eruptions of volcanoes with the
absolutely
steam up above.
And the deep ocean vents.
And these vents are now, we can measure them with, we have techniques.
We've got people, they're sending vehicles down with cameras all over them, and they're looking at the water that is gushing
erupting
out of the floor of the ocean. And there are animals down there that are living in these sulfur-rich acid waters,
mm-hmm. and they're doing pretty well down there.
They're doing pretty well, and so this gives you an idea that there's not only water deep within the crust, but there could be biological life living on that water, mm-hmm. which is an interesting thing. This is where our friend Thomas Gold comes in.
He's a student of this, or
Thomas Gold is a wonderful elderly a British astronomer who is now at Cornell University, mm-hmm. and he's been saying for some time that not only does methane occur naturally deep within the crust of the Earth, but there's also water there. And he refers to what he calls a deep, hot biosphere.
Okay.
So he says not only is there water deep within the earth, but there is also methane, and there are organisms living on it.
Oh.
And of course he's saying that this is has of great importance to the origin and extent of petroleum resources in the world. The way petroleum has been developing around the world, it does seem as if some of the resources of petroleum are living longer than people anticipated. And that suggests that there are sources of the petroleum away from the place where the wells were originally dug. Now, of course, Thomas Gold has run into a bit of strife with the petroleum community, and they don't necessarily sing his praises. In fact, they do the opposite. But I suspect that Thomas Gold had a very perceptive view of it.
So the prevailing idea in the textbooks when I studied geology is, you mean that you were to think that water crept down near the potential eruption site of a volcano and got hot and then came up. It's not that it was part of the deep earth. Is that
all of the textbooks on volcanoes and also on the deep ocean vents all show a source of water in some other place percolating down and then coming
getting heated up and then steaming up.
Yeah, and so in the case of the normal vision of the volcanoes with all the steam that comes out of the top, over there somewhere there's a crack in the earth down which water percolates and gets down into the rocks down here and gets heated up by the rocks and up comes the steam.
So you're saying, and Dr. Gold and other people and there are other scientists, that actually there's a deep composition and it's still in progress of the earth. And let me ask you then, if that's the case, is the fact that we have oceans now, what does this presuppose about where this water came from?
Well, can we just go back on that and get on to the concept of the expanding Earth?
Okay, all right.
About 40-odd years ago, I was a young engineer in Tasmania, and I was measuring rock stresses for a underground power station we were building.
I forgot to say you're a civil engineer, right?
Yes.
Training, okay.
Mainly involved in dams and big underground power stations and things, tunnels. And we measured the stress in the rock, and I thought, gee whiz, this is much higher than I thought it would be. So I went to see a professor of geology at the University of Tasmania, a man by the name of Samuel Warren Carey. And he looked at my data and said, yeah, well, it's in the right direction. The stress is in the right direction. And they seem to be okay to me. And then he showed me some of the work he'd been doing on continental drift.
Mm-hmm.
But his was a little bit different, in that he was cutting out the continents on a sphere, and he was cutting them out at the edge of the continental shelf, and he was trying to match them, and they were matching. Then if he put them on a blank globe, they matched very well.
Like a puzzle on a globe, it
just
all
like
fit.
Yes, it all fitted.
Okay.
But there were great gaps. In other words, where all the presentations are. So they fitted together in part, and the fit wasn't that good. And then he was working on a globe of about 80%.
You mean smaller?
Yeah.
20% smaller.
20% smaller. A globe, 20% smaller. So he had cut out the continents on a globe of the present size as a model, and then he had another globe 20% smaller, and lo and behold, all the continents fitted together fairly nicely, and there wasn't any space for any oceans at all.
So it was all landmass.
It was all landmass.
Okay.
And so he formulated his concept of the expanding Earth. And I looked at it, and as far as I was concerned, it was obvious the Earth had been expanding. Well, it was obvious to me and Sam Carey, but it wasn't obvious to most other people in the world, because they asked the question, what caused the expansion?
Yeah.
And the fact was that Sam didn't know. He just said, this is the evidence.
Yeah.
And the important thing, all the geology lined up on either side of the...
You mean it matched the adjacent...
Oh, absolutely,
currently,
just like that, you know.
Currently distant land masses matched up and have the same...
Yeah, indeed. Mm-hmm. Australia, India, Antarctica, South Africa. And it was all clicking together rather nicely. And so he came up with this concept of the expanding Earth. And of course, He was ridiculed a bit. And as a result of his various proposals and others, in order to keep the concept of an Earth of the same size, the idea of plate tectonics was evolved, whereby things...
Oh, they go underneath.
They go under. So the concept of plate tectonics was essentially devised to be able to explain this phenomena of the movements of the continents on a constant size.
Of course, excuse me, you do have major shifts in the Eurasian landmass around India and China. That's okay, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, now, having got to that stage, Sam found that he was essentially blocked because of this idea of plate tectonics. But you see, then another lot of information started to appear. We started to measure the age of the ocean floors. And over about the last 20 years, there's been a lot of wonderful work being done on not only looking at the way we have these mid-ocean rifts where rock comes out and spreads laterally, and they've been able to measure the direction of magnetism in it, and they have the stripes, and they've also have got measures of determining the age. And so not only does the, in the mid-ocean rifts, does the rock come out and spread out just like that, they've also been able to measure the age of it.
So some are new, you're saying?
Oh,
so
well,
to speak. In
oh, yeah, well,
time.
Well, there are rocks there that are 5 million years old and 50, 60, 70, 80. And so the bulk of the floor of the oceans, they've got now measurements over a lot of it.
Okay.
And the oldest age is about 200, 250 million years. Fits in very nicely with Sam's view that it was all together as one 200 odd million years ago. And so all of the data on the age of the ocean floors has enabled us to understand that the Earth has been progressively expanding. And so not only do we have an expansion of the Earth, we've got an expansion of the oceans, the hydrosphere.
Of the water on the surface, apparently.
Right. And so the next question then is, how did all this expansion occur? And now, intellectually, we're still locked into the concept that the Earth is of a constant diameter, and the atmosphere is a constant amount, and the hydrosphere is a constant amount. And this brings us now, if we can just digress onto Kyoto.
the famous meeting and treaty against
Global warming.
Climate change.
And climate change and global warming. In Kyoto, the various people involved were locked into the idea that the Earth is a constant size and the atmosphere is a constant size. And so all of the treaty was based on that.
Yeah.
Now, the actual fact, of course, is that the Earth is under continual bombardment from the sun, the solar wind,
yes,
and all these ions hurting towards
yes.
the Earth. And the idea of a constant Earth, on which Kyoto is based, the idea of a constant Earth means that the incoming mass and energy from the sun is exactly balanced by the outgoing radiation of mass and energy by the Earth. And they're two huge sums. And it's absolutely ridiculous to say that they're equal. And I think it's fairly obvious that there is a net gain, and we don't know what it is. But I think it's obvious that there is a gain, and we have to work out now how it is occurring. One of the things I've been looking at and trying to puzzle about is the what is lightning, for example. And particularly in the tropics, we have lots of sheet lightning, where sheets flash, the whole sky will flash. And now, how does that happen? Well, the incoming solar radiation is, if you like, positive and negative ions. And they're widely dispersed. And so they can travel independently without discharging against one another. But as the solar wind comes to the Earth and it becomes concentrated by the Earth's gravity, these positive and negative ions come together, and eventually there's a sufficient concentration of these positive and negative ions, they can have, if you like, a spontaneous discharge. So sheet lightning in the tropics, and you're seeing it all the time, in the tropics, sheet lightning is the, if you like, the spontaneous creation of water from the solar wind. Hmm. And so this helps us a bit. We all know when there's a great lightning storm, you get lots of water. And so this gives us a hint as to the way this increase in mass is occurring. And similarly, if you get down to Antarctica or somewhere like that, and you look at the sky, the incoming meteors, they're just... The sky is alive with falling stars.
So you have empirical proof that absolutely. Things are changing. You are witnessing change.
All the time.
So back to also your the idea of the geologic history, but that we're living history now.
Oh, absolutely.
You also, and you had colleagues before you, decades earlier, but look at the Great Artesian Basin,
yes.
And check out, does the volcano
yes.
pattern, does the...
Oh, yes.
Maps to prove the evidence of this.
I'll have to go back to Gregory.
There's a famous name in... British geologist.
British geologist, Scottish, if you like.
Okay, yes.
And he went down to London in about 1885 or something like that as a young man, and he studied at the Mechanics Institute. He got a job with the British Museum, and he did so well at the Mechanics Institute, the British Museum allowed him to go to the University of London. He did a Bachelor of Science, did extraordinarily well, first class honours. He stayed on for a couple of years and got a Doctor of Science.
So well trained.
Yes, and he was obviously a talented and capable geologist. And the British Museum sent him to America to have a look at the Rocky Mountains,
yeah.
the geysers in Wyoming, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was also involved in the first expedition to cross Spitsbergen. And around about 1895, they sent him down to Africa to have a look at the Great Rift Valley.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to collect some porters, and off he set. At that time, people were sort of trudging through those areas. They had to be fairly intrepid, you know. There weren't an awful lot of friends around. And so he went to the Great Rift Valley, and he saw these hot lakes, water in the Great Rift Valley, here it was, high in the middle of Africa. And he immediately knew that the water in those lakes had never been surface rainfall.
Okay.
It was all water that was coming out of the crust of the earth, and he was pretty good. His book, by the way, on his visit to the Great Rift Valley, is still in print.
What's it called? The Great Rift Valley.
Great Rift Valley.
Okay.
The Great Rift Valley of Africa. He was first to use the term the Great Rift Valley, and one of the rifts in Kenya is still called the Gregory Rift, and so he. Saw and understood this, and he could see that it was a zone of expansion in the Earth's crust, the Great Rift, of course, and there are associated volcanoes nearby. And so it put together a picture for him, and it was really remarkably thoughtful for the time. And a few years later, in about 1900, the University of Melbourne was seeking a professor of geology, and he applied for the job, and he was the only one that was interviewed. He just automatically got the job, and he went to Melbourne. And on his first, if you like, summer vacation, as we have summer vacation, he set off with a party of students to Central Australia, the dead heart of Australia, to look at the flowing wells.
And the flowing wells meaning
the
wells...
artesian bores that were flowing. The wells that farmers had drilled down, and here's the water gushing out.
So you had this...
And he only had to smell the waters and smell the hydrogen sulfide and all the rest of it. And he says, these are not normal artesian waters from rainfall. These are waters from deep within the crust of the earth, and they've always been there.
Meaning associated with hot magma or some processes.
He knew, for example, that the whiteness in quartz was due to water.
Okay.
This water came from the same sort of sources.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all part of the original constitution of the earth. Now, of course, that concept that there were waters which were part of the original constitution of the earth was totally new at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are running the Artesian Basin in the Queensland government, for example, they just couldn't possibly believe it. And they were saying, look, if it, water isn't from sources
from the rain and surface
from the rain, it must be percolating down from New Guinea or the Himalaya.
Way underground.
Yes, indeed. And so and they were totally convinced. And of course, they consulted some American groundwater hydrologists who are sort of busily exploiting some of the groundwater here. And the American groundwater said, people said, all groundwater comes from surface water. That was enough for those guys because they didn't have to think anymore.
That was 100 years ago.
So Gregory stuck to his guns, but he didn't get anywhere. So he went back to England, became a professor of geology in Glasgow. But in New South Wales and in Queensland, the government geologists, in order to appease the politicians and to settle the argument once and for all, they wrote these papers saying these waters came from surface rainfall.
Okay.
Now, and Gregory, a few years later, wrote a rebuttal of that. Now, that was 100 years ago. About 3 years ago or so, I was visiting Queensland talking about my railroad proposals, and I heard a presentation by the chairman of the Consultative Council of the Great Artesian Basin, who was a farmer. I said, mate, you've got it wrong. This is not the way it is at all. And so I...
He said he needed more water, the wells...
All he said was that the wells are drying up and it depends on surface rainfall.
Okay.
This is the way it goes.
Okay.
And I said, champ, that's wrong. And then some amazing things happened. I wrote a small paper on it. I sent it to this particular chairman, who's a farmer, and so he took it down to Canberra to show it around. And the Queensland government hit the roof, saying that water was a state responsibility. And then the Queensland, and I said to my this chap that I was going to publish my paper in the Academy. And the Queensland government wrote to the Academy and said, don't publish that paper. They're very interesting. And then the Queensland government enacted legislation proclaiming the areas where the water had to enter the ground.
the rainfall surface water.
Where the surface water had to enter the ground.
Underground runoff.
To flow into the Great Artesian Basin. And, of course, all the farmers in the area got
They said that's off-limits?
They proclaimed the area saying the farmers couldn't use the surface water because that
the
was an area...
preservation area.
Yes.
Okay.
That was the area of recharge. So local farmers hit the roof and the argument is still going on.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
Okay, so that's the question of science is an immediate question of economy.
Well, one of the tragedies is that we've tended to move away from the capacity to speculate and to think about issues. And we're always trying to make things black and white, which is never the case. And this means that we've got ourselves into the crazy situation where even in the universities, speculation is not on. And the idea that we can't speculate is reinforced by this mad system of peer review and all the rest of it. I think there's an awful lot of young people in the universities at the moment that are being held in a system of thought control because all speculation is out of court. Unless you can prove things absolutely, it's not scientific. Well, all the great scientific discoveries of the world began with speculation.
And with problems, as you say. And in fact, well, let's switch for a minute, because we look forward to having you back after, I know you're working actively on refuting the misconceptions of groundwater. You're going to be looking at Middle Eastern data and so forth. But let's switch then for a minute to another area of control where it said, it's not economical to build great projects. We don't have the money to develop our resources. And you were in on just the opposite. After the Second World War, you were building things. If you can tell us something about that, the Snowy Mountain project, then we'll come to what you propose for today.
Well, let's begin a little bit earlier in America.
Okay.
When Roosevelt came to power, and it's worthwhile going to his inaugural because I think it's fantastic. Roosevelt got on with the job with the TVA and Grand Coulee. He had the Bureau of Reclamation already going well. And Hoover Dam. And they were absolutely wonderful projects. And the important thing was that every one of them was big and challenging. Hoover Dam was by far the highest dam in the world. It was an arch dam. They had to develop new techniques of analysis to work out the stresses in the dam. The mere matter of the diversion of the Colorado River past the dam site was a fantastic operation.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they had these largest turbo generators in the world. And there was huge steel pipelines. And they had to develop new ways of welding these great pipes and so on. So there was a great deal of activity in Hoover, which was exciting and interesting, and it challenged the Bureau, and they lifted. The same thing was happening in the TVA. And the TVA was an absolutely incredible project because it covered so much countryside in Kentucky and Tennessee. Hundreds of thousands of people involved. And in the case of the Tennessee Valley project, what was absolutely amazing is that all of the people in the valley, hundreds of thousands, were all captured by the idea. And they all worked together for a common purpose. And there was no sense anywhere of people doing their own thing or individual purposes. Everybody was united towards a common goal. It was an absolutely fabulous time. Now, I was reading about these sort of things in the technical press, of course. I was watching it all like mad.
They had music evenings to give briefings on why you should use electricity.
Yes. Well, it was all a wonderful time. Now, this was also being monitored around the world because everybody was interested in these fantastic steps forward that Roosevelt was making. And one of the places where that was noted was, of course, Australia. And we'd been thinking about the inland diversion of the Snowy River for some time. And so after the war, we started getting on developing plans for the building of this Snowy Mountains project. But there are other people around the world also looking at all sorts of new plans for redevelopment. And we started this project. The Act went through in 1949. And we then had an immediate problem because we really didn't have the strength in depth within our organization to get on with the job. We started off with a commissioner who was a hard-bitten old hydroelectric construction engineer. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he was a wonderful leader, and a bunch of young engineers like myself.
Well, tell us more now. How did the Snowy Mountain training come about that you could go from one thing to another?
Okay. Well, what happened was that we just had this two or three senior people with a background and a bunch of young engineers. And one of the things that we did was that the Snowy organization entered into a contract with the United States government whereby we paid, this is Australian money, no aid or anything like this, we paid the Bureau of Reclamation in Denver, Colorado to help us with the design of the first major tunnels and the first major dam, or two dams, and in the process help us by training some of the young engineers. And so in 1952 I was sent to Denver, Colorado, and I was told by the Snowy that I had to learn to be an expert in tunnels and underground construction.
In how long?
Oh, as quick as possible.
Okay.
And so I was sent to Denver, and the bureau engineers, they set us down, and I sat down at an empty drawing board, and I started to draw up the first tunnel, the 14-mile long Yucubinchium diversion tunnel. And so I did that, and I was beavering away there for 12 months. And it was wonderful working with these bureau engineers, because they were all 20 and 30 years older than me.
And they had all this experience.
Yeah, and they just sort of saunter up on my desk and say, why don't you do think about this or have a go at that? And every now and again they'd disappear, and they'd come back with a book or a specification with a few things marked in it for me. And there was this wonderful relationship between these older Bureau of Reclamation engineers and the team of 12 young Australians. And of course, you can imagine, being Australians, there was lots of banter, and everybody had a good time. But there was a wonderful human relationship there. And after 12 months, I was going back to Australia with a bundle of drawings and specifications, so I'm hoping I could answer all the questions when I got home on the details.
And it worked, right?
Oh, yes. And so we then got on with calling tenders and getting on with the construction of the projects. And then there was another nice development. The Bureau of Reclamation had a number of older engineers in their late 60s, 70s, who had been construction engineers on, or resident engineers on Glen Canyon or Grand Coulee, you name it. Some of them in the Colorado, Big Thompson. And they had these construction engineers who'd been there and done it. And so we arranged for them to come and stay with us for a period of 12 months or so. And they sat down with us, and they helped us with the administration of these very large contracts. You know, these were, you know, multi-million dollar contracts, quite huge things in those days. And once again, the relationships were rather wonderful. Because we'd get into a problem with a contract, and we're worrying about this and that. And they'd say, well, this is the way we did it at Palisades.
Yeah.
And off they'd go, and they'd come back with some data for us. And of course, there was absolutely wonderful relations. And by then, some of us were a bit older. We had children, and they were part of the grandfather's circuit of all the young Australian community. And the relationships were absolutely fantastic. And so the project was built on time and within the estimate. And it was a great, complex project. And it was this sort of harmonious relationship with the Bureau that held it along.
So that the examples of this, which I know have been recently published and available in Australia in the periodical The Citizen, are very appropriate to the Franklin Delano Roosevelt approach today.
Oh, that's right.
Because
yes.
They're directly a spin-off, thanks yes. to people like you. And then you built more underground power facilities
yes.
and that kind of thing.
Well, you see, when you start off with a rocket behind you, which happened to me, and this applied to most of the young Australians that were involved in this, because of the fact that they were expected to become experts, they were trained to be experts, within about 8 years or so, we're operating at World Front. And the interesting thing is that had already been working on the design and construction of two large underground power stations. And at that time, the Bureau of Reclamation had not designed and built an underground power station.
So that was a first?
Yes. And so, no, the Bureau of Reclamation, they were watching us.
So these are underground turbine stations?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Large underground power stations. Well, there were two in the Snowy scheme, and I worked on the first one of those. But by then, as we were completing this first large underground power station, I was then invited to go to Tasmania, where the Hydroelectric Commission in Tasmania were designing and building their first underground power station. So I went to Tasmania, and once again we had a government instrumentality, a government utility, and we had an interesting charter from the Tasmanian government as a government utility. Tasmania is a hydroelectric island.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the orders from the government were we were to generate the lowest cost hydropower in the world so that we would attract industries to Tasmania. And so, in other words, as a government department, we were ordered by the government to operate at the frontiers of technology and design and construction to keep the prices as low as possible. And you can only do that by technical excellence.
Yeah.
And so we are encouraged again. We were the first in the world to use hard rock tunneling machines, boring tunnels. And that was an interesting exercise in that we wanted to drill these several miles of tunnels through hard rock and hard sedimentary sandstones and things like that. And we found in America there was a firm that had built a soft shale cutting machine.
For shale, not coal?
No, soft shale. This was at the Missouri River diversion, on one of the Missouri projects.
Yes.
And one of the Missouri River projects. And this was a Corps of Engineers project. And they had used, for a fairly short distance, a soft shale cutting machine. But we saw that they had the electric motor drive system, which we wanted. So we got in touch with this firm in Seattle. There's some problems there with the firm. And in essence, the Hydroelectric Commission in Tasmania provided funds to refloat this company in Seattle. So here's a government department doing this sort of thing to help us design and build this hard rock tunneling machine, which we were going to ship to Tasmania.
And it worked.
And it worked. We sent our plant engineers over there. They worked in Seattle with the firm in Seattle. And then they came back to Australia with the machine. We put it up to the face, and it worked like a charm. We realized we couldn't get the muck away quick enough. We were doing so well.
So to haul out the muck.
So we had to put a whole, redesign the conveyor belt system and everything else to move the muck quickly, and we were breaking world records.
Well, let me ask you then about, this is the positive idea of building infrastructure, but we all know wherever we live, almost, that the last 20 years then, things lagged, there was a pause, and you are now saying that not just in power generation, but in railroads, you have a peculiarly dramatic situation in the railroad gauges in Australia.
Yeah.
But can you switch then to tell us, in your expert opinion, if we were to start tomorrow to have that same spirit and technology commitment, what should we be doing there?
Well, the wonderful thing about Roosevelt is that he identified not only problems in America, it helped to inspire a similar approach around the world. And you only have to look at the situation in Africa and South America, parts of Asia and so on. There is a need for much new infrastructure. And the problem is that the world is divided in various ways. In Africa, the sort of projects that should be built involve several countries. In the Middle East, the problems of groundwater are sort of heading towards warfare, almost. And so it's really a matter of trying to overcome the political problems. If you can put the political structure together, the rest is easy.
Well, one thing I know, you've developed maps to show Australia, but in political, social terms, how it's part of a whole 4 billion people, if you count India and China and East Asia and Southeast Asia, so that it could be a positive location, not a strife location.
We have to look at that market.
Okay.
You see, we're just 20 million people in Australia, and one of our problems to date is that our Constitution, which to a certain extent was based on the US Constitution, preserved a sovereign power at state level.
Oh, is it not federal, state?
At state level. And so that means that the various states of Australia agreed to the Constitution on the basis that they preserved sovereign power. And the federal government was only granted powers for defence and foreign affairs and trade and so on. That meant the states were responsible for water, electricity, and transport.
Transport, too. Uh-huh.
And so that meant that the states, and for the last 100 years, have hung on to not only the separate ports, but separate rail systems and of different gauges.
Oh, no.
And so the state, but you see, at the time of the Constitution, that was regarded as a plus.
Oh, no.
Because the separate gauges leading to each port meant that the other states wouldn't interfere.
Oh, wouldn't compete for the hinterland traffic.
And if you like, this idea of separate state sovereignty still remains. I was in the Northern Territory 2 or 3 years ago, and one of the local bureaucrats told me very proudly how the Chief Minister of the Northern Territory, which is probably about 200,000 or less people, had recently been in Beijing and had signed a memorandum of understanding with the Premier of China.
Oh, a state.
You know, I thought, what madness this is. But okay, if you look at the situation from the Australian point of view, there is still enormous potential in the north and so on. And if you look at the markets to our north, Darwin, for example, the distance from Darwin to Singapore is the same distance as the length of the Mediterranean Sea. So we can be communicating with all of that part of Asia and entering into trade with Asia. If you see the map and you see the distances between Singapore and Japan, at any one time, half of the world's container ships are in the seas between Singapore and Japan. Half of the world's containers are there. So it's a huge area based on maritime trade, and that's easy to understand when you think of all the islands of the Indonesian archipelago.
Yeah, merchandise, food,
a whole lot. So we are in a good position to trade with that area and also to be a source of food.
So this would help define infrastructure.
Oh, absolutely.
To build up ports and
roads. This is what I'm getting at, is that the 4 billion market and their needs drives infrastructure development in Australia, because in effect we would be designing and building to sell Australian produce and our goods into that market.
So that's how you see, you tell us something about the railroad, new railroad patterns, or new irrigated farming patterns.
Yes.
You have a terrific climate in Australia.
Oh, yes. Well, you see, I've been working on a new railroad system that goes up through the middle of the Murray-Darling Basin, a major irrigation area.
Mm-hmm. Where it isn't now, you mean?
Well, it is. It's a great irrigation area at the moment.
But the railroad is that?
The railroad is new.
Okay.
The Murray-Darling Basin has the, we can double or triple the output by getting a better access to market.
Okay.
You see, in Australia, we have this, what they call a tyranny of distance. And economic development depends on access to markets. If you change the access to markets, you improve the value of crops, you change the sort of crops you grow, changes the value of water. So if we have, if you like, rapid transport systems that connect Australian farms effectively to Asian markets, it changes what we grow, it changes the value of land, it changes the everything. And so I've been looking at transport projects to bring Australian produce to these markets. Now, if we can do that successfully, we could easily support another 20 million people in Australia.
Right. And also, besides the rail then, you're thinking of inter-island and rapid marine travel. Have you been involved in that?
Well, down in Tasmania, they've been designing these twin-hull catamarans.
Oh, yeah.
And these are fairly rapid. In fact, a twin-hulled catamaran made in Hobart holds the speed record across the Atlantic.
Oh, really? How fast?
Average speed of about 45 knots, I think.
Okay.
Something like that. You know, it's pretty quick.
Just a few days, a couple days.
Yeah. One of my guys, a student in the faculty when I was dean, he did some wonderful work with them, and of course with the builders of this machine. You can imagine with a twin hull catamaran, it's a devilish problem if you're running into a cross sea.
Straight ahead, you mean?
Yeah, when you're going like this, you see. One hull will hit the wave before the other hull.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so there's a bit of this sort of thing. And so this young student, well, not a student, he's 40 odd. He's one of our graduate students. And he was able to devise a sensing mechanism and computer program so that the flaps at the end, at the stern of the catamaran, would go up and down like this. And so he had a sensing device to monitor the sea state, determine which hull was going to hit the water at which time, and the whole thing was adjusted, and it was just as steady as can be.
Oh, terrific.
And they used that on the Atlantic crossing. Now, these fast catamarans, they're very good, and this chap's got designs for them with, you know, 500, 1,000 containers, which are good for if you like, inter-island travel, which you'd have right
in Indonesia
that archipelago.
Mm-hmm.
Bit of fun.
So the technology is there.
The will. You see, with a lot of these things, every one of them requires a leapfrog in thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been talking at this meeting over the last few days about the railroad which could go from China all the way through Kiev into the heart of Europe. And you'd have Russia and China all connected up as one common market, a fantastic rail project which could go ahead. And the question is, where is all the money going to come from and everything else? And the fact is that the money is, in many cases, relatively easily found.
Well, in North America, you may have something to say about the idea that that railroad should go through Russia, I mean, from Kiev eastward through China under the Bering Straits and into the Yukon and Canada. Yeah. Do you have a tunneling expert's opinion?
There are various technologies which are available these days, and you have to look at the cost of it. With a tunnel like that, you'd want to stay away from problems in the rock underneath, and you'd want to stay away from a floating bridge or bridge tunnel arrangement. But it is possible to have a tunnel made of pontoons, constructed in the dry, and then taken out to the site, and in effect floating, submerged, if you like,
on the sea surface,
above the seabed. They could be floating
on
submerged, anchored to the seabed,
mm-hmm.
and so you could have a floating tunnel anchored to the seabed, and just join it up. So you're independent of the rock conditions underneath, and you're independent of the sea state, and it's just a matter of paying for the box and screwing it to the floor.
You make sure there's no holes, that's right.
Make sure there's... Well, you see, that's easy fix. You'd use longitudinal pre-stressing, all sorts of things to make sure
right.
it worked very nicely.
Is one of those in place in
no,
a significant
no,
way?
Not that I know of. They may be, but it's the sort of thing that... And the Bering Strait is the sort of place where that sort of thing could be done.
This could be the challenge that the projects of the Franklin Delano Roosevelt were.
Yes.
In the 1930s.
He had the courage to have a go.
And you know, one other. You said that after you retired, you're a civil engineer, actively retired. You're now in your most exciting thinking period in your life to try and work on, and so your priority is on setting straight the groundwater misconceptions of Earth history?
Primarily national development.
Okay.
You see, when you're practicing, and as I was working for the government or when I was at the university, you are largely constrained by the system telling you what to do. Now, if you're an employee, you have to do what the boss says. If you're in a government, you have to do what the government says. When you're in a university, and particularly these days with privatization and all sorts of things, you're totally dependent on what money people will give you for research. So your research is totally determined outside, and the idea of free scholarship is totally lost. So since I retired, I've been a free scholar. For the first time in my life, I've been totally free, and I can think what I like, do what I like, travel where I want to. Not that I've got the money to do it. But the important thing is that when you're as free as all that, all of a sudden, a great world of opportunity opens up, and there's so much to be done. And there are so many blockages. Governments all around the world, problems.
Well, one thing is you're making available the levers and handles to reconceptualize, to push ahead. Mm. You mentioned Professor Gold, Professor
yes.
Gregory, Professor Carey, these mm. other people.
Yes.
Do you think among hydrologists and geochemists, but otherwise, you can force things through in the near future? What's your view?
I am hoping that there are young people out there.
Okay.
I'm hoping that there are young ones that see these opportunities and grab them and run with them. And the more courage they have to think for themselves and work things out, the better. One of the things that worries me is that our entire generation of young people are being conditioned, and they've lost this capacity to think independently. I could go on and mention my concern about American teenagers.
You mean that they're market composed instead of mentally composed?
The problem here is that there's a whole advertising and other industry preying on the American teenager, because the American teenager's got money to spend. And the money that American teenagers spend every year themselves is about $100 billion. The money that their parents spend on their behalf is another $50 billion. So the American teenage market is worth $150 billion every year. You could build an awful lot of things for $150 billion a year. You know, from my point of view, $150 billion on spiky hairdos and bare midriffs is a total waste of money.
Yeah, whereas if we put it, you mean, in building projects, since you were young and that's how you got
your... Sure.
You could create natural resources.
Absolutely. But you see, the system is actually preying on these young people and limiting their ability to think for themselves. They are being driven so that, in effect, they worship the corporate sponsor. And they don't listen to their parents or their teachers. And it means that they're losing the capacity to work together. You see, all the sports they're encouraged to do, all the things they do, the skateboards, you name it, there's not too much group activity anymore. There's not too many orchestras and choirs and bands and things like that. There's not too many group sports for young people.
Well, I'll tell you, since the financial system that's been crazy that allowed that is breaking down, I think it's now's our opportunity, now
Absolutely.
Or never, as they say. And I'm so glad you were here today,
right.
Professor Lance Endersby, and we look forward to having you back to report on your progress.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.